When I talked last time about that extremely difficult rhythm in the Babbitt piece, it's similar also in some of Cage's music that tends to be extremely difficult. And the reason the difficulty is there is that it comes out of reasoning that's governed by a process, which we talked about before. And Milton's music tends, as you know very well, to be highly process-oriented. And that rhythm I showed you came as a result of two different processes at the same time. One process told him he had to have 5 equally spaced notes in a certain amount of time. And another process told him where that had to start and where that had to end. So he didn't really have any choice in his own mind about what he was doing in that case because the process itself governed it. You'll find similar things in some of Cage's music. Not all of his music is notated the same way, but some of it's extremely difficult for the same reason that some chance procedure says this note has to be placed here, and rhythmically that can be extremely difficult. I don't think there's any two composers in American history that were more process-oriented than Cage and Babbitt. And that's going to be one of the biggest changes you're going to see in the next generation of composers. This week you're listening also to a piece by Donald Martino. And Donald Martino is a 60-year-old composer who's one of the composers here at Harvard. And he was one of Milton's students. And the piece you're going to listen to, Notturno, which actually won the Pulitzer Prize back in the 70s sometime, I forgot which year, is serial on every level with respect to pitch. You can explain every note in the piece by a kind of series that's working in the piece. But unlike Milton or John Cage, where they took all of the different elements of music apart and composed them all independently, Martino puts them all back together and the piece becomes very expressive. The dynamics are to help support the melody. The rhythms are to make the thing flow. They're not independently composed anymore. So Martino's music, in a way, I hate to even use the term, but in a certain way, it's kind of almost more old-fashioned because it relies on more of the tradition of European music in the way it's composed than in a way Babbitt did. Also, it's interesting that Babbitt really never studied in Europe, which was an extreme temptation for composers of his age because there were very few composition teachers in this country. And almost all the composition teachers in this country studied in Europe. So generally, most of the good composers went to Europe, especially in the 30s, and the 20s to at least get the European tradition. And Babbitt never did, but Martino did. Martino studied in Italy for several years and is very influenced by the kind of lyricism of his teachers there. It's interesting also that because of the kind of processes Babbitt uses and Cage used, that occasionally there's almost a similarity in the sound of their music. And this was proven rather drastically on your midterm. The very first listening example was a piece by Milton Babbitt, and many of you guessed John Cage. And so you can see, I've done that also with graduate students in composition, where I'll play a piece of Milton Babbitt and a piece of John Cage and ask them to guess which is which, and they can't. Now, this is not true of all the pieces, and I'm not trying to make this a huge generality, but this notion of a process governing a piece and all of the elements taken apart is very much a factor in both of their music that separates them from almost every other composer I know. What I thought I would do today is try in technical terms, not musical technical terms, but in kind of detail, to explain a little bit of how that piece was written that you heard on your midterm. It's a piece called Concertini. And it's written for 5 players. It's written for flute and cello, piano, marimba, and vibraphone. I think some of you said xylophone on the test. The difference between a marimba and a xylophone is a wooden instrument played with mallets. It's a percussion instrument, but it's a rather high one. It starts here and goes up to here. A marimba is the same thing, but it goes much lower. A marimba goes all the way down to here. And the bars are much bigger, but it's basically the same instrument as a xylophone. A vibraphone, if you don't know, is a similar kind of instrument, except it has metal bars. And under the metal bars, it has a damper with a pedal. So if you press the pedal down, the bars are free to keep ringing, and so it'll sustain. Where if you hit a marimba bar, it's not going to keep ringing, it's just a piece of wood. So a vibraphone gives you that kind of tinkle. I thought I'd play a little bit of the piece first and then explain it to you as best I can. Thank you. 3/4 of the first section, the pieces in 5 parts, will come back. Oh, I didn't mention there's also a lot of unpitched percussion. You heard tom-toms and cymbals and wood blocks and that kind of stuff. But in a certain way, those don't count, which I'll explain later. The other night, I was trying to think of how to explain this piece in a kind of coherent way, and I was talking to my brother. My brother's a landscape architect, a very good one. So when I hung up, I thought to myself, well, what if Milton Babbitt didn't write music but made gardens? How would his garden come out? And actually, this piece broke down into a rather interesting garden if you just sort of draw certain parallels. Also, I think if you think of John Cage as a gardener, also, it makes it very clear the difference between the two of them, because Cage certainly would take the approach of gardening of just scattering the seeds and letting them come up wherever they did and enjoying his garden that way. In fact, he's a great fan of there's a very famous Japanese gardener who's sort of the John Cage of gardening, Masanobu Fukuoka, who wrote a book called The One Straw Revolution, which reads very much like Silence. It's a very interesting book. And Cage's apartment itself is a huge garden. He lives in a loft in New York. And in the loft, he has well over 100 trees and about 500 plants and thousands of rocks from all over the world. And you sort of wander through, and every once in a while, there's a little piece of furniture. And on the wall, there's incredible artwork, because he was friends of all, you know, with friends of all the great artists in New York. But you can't see most of the artwork anymore because the trees have grown so much. You sort of like look through and you see a Rauschenberg behind the tree. It's quite a wonderful loft. He's been there a long time. So let's talk about this piece as though we were a garden. The elements I'm going to use in this garden is I'm going to have 5 different kinds of flowers. There's 5 different instruments in this piece, so let's represent them with 5 flowers. Each flower type is 1 color. So let's say I choose roses as one of my flower types. It'll be red. But it'll come in 3 shades of red. It'll come in a bright red, a regular red, and a dark red. And in addition, each of my flower types will come in 6 different heights. Let's say 1 inch, 2, 3, 5, 8, and 13, if we want to use Fibonacci or something. Now, the first thing I'm going to do about my garden is that it's going to be in 5 large sections. And each section is going to have the same form to it. We're going to have, in each section, 7 rows of planted flowers. The first row will have all 5 different types. The second row will have 2 kinds. The next row will have 2 kinds. The next row after that will have 3 kinds. And these 3 kinds will be the 3 kinds that aren't in these 2. So when you put these 2 together, you'd have all 5. The next row will have all 3 kinds. And those 3 kinds are the 3 that are not in this one over here. Then I'm going to have a solo. 1 flower will be featured. And then I'm going to have a quartet of flowers. And the quartet will be the 4 flowers that are not the solo. So if this were a rose, this would be the other 4 kinds. And this is going to happen 5 times in a row. Why 5 times in a row? Well, remember, I've talked to you a lot about how Babbitt's music is a lot about saturation of process, doing every possible thing within the process. Well, how many possible duets do you have with 5 different players? You have 1 and 2, 1 and 3, 1 and 4, 1 and 5, 2 and 3, 2 and 4, 2 and 5, 3 and 4, 3 and 5, and 4 and 5. That's 10 different types. So if I have 5 sections, and each section has 2 duets, then I have every possible combination of duet. Right? The same thing is true with trios. If I go through, I don't have enough fingers to do that very clearly, but if I went through and showed you all possibilities of how many trios you could have, there are 10 different possibilities. So if I have 5 sections again, I can have all 10 different possibilities. Then, obviously, if I have 1 solo or 1 featured element in each section, with 5 sections, I'll have featured everyone. So again, we have this kind of saturation of every possible identity going through. And as I say, every single section is going to go through this exact same procedure, starting with the whole group playing, then condensing it to only duets, building the trios, going to a solo, and then ending with a quartet. And every time it'll do that. The piece you're going to listen to, Aria da Capo, is very similar. The details are different, but the basic logic is the same. Now, the whole thing, because I can't ever remember numbers very well, the whole thing is going to be governed by a numerical series of 12 elements. a numerical series that could govern it would be one like this. I'll use 1 through 12 rather than 0 through 11, I think, today, just to make it easier. 1, 12, 6, 4, 10. Let me just put up this many for the sake of talking. Okay. Now, what am I going to govern in this garden when I plant? What details of it am I going to think about? Well, first of all, what I'm going to do is I'm going to have a grid. And the grid is going to be 12 units high. And 12 units going that way. Let's call them inches for now, okay? That's a little small for planting at this scale, but let's call them inches. Now, these will come in groups of 12, and each section will have a different amount of how many of these there are. Let's just say, for the sake of discussion, that in the very first subsection of the piece, the first time when all five play, that let's say it'll be about 20 units long. And let's say that it's these units are seconds, for example, so there's 12 seconds in each unit, and multiply that by 20, and you'd have the length of the first section. Now, first of all, let's talk about where a flower can be planted on the grid, not in terms of vertical, but only horizontal. I'll come back to the vertical in just a second. Let's say I decide to take this series, for now, backwards, 5, 10, 4, 6, 12, 1. Well, the first place I can plant would be on the fifth space in the grid, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, which I didn't get up to. So it could go, it's going to go in one of those spaces. Let's not say which one yet, but it's going to go on 5. Okay, now when I get to my next grid of 12 by 12, I have several choices, or Milton Babbitt allows himself one of three choices. Either I can repeat where I did it the last time and put it again on 5. I can choose just to skip over that one and not even have a flower planted there if I don't want to. Or I can move on to my next element and I can plant it on the 10th unit over here. Okay? Now the next thing he's going to do is he's going to, remember we have six heights of flowers. These six heights of flowers I'm comparing to dynamics or how loud notes are in his music. He's going to link, now this isn't quite totally accurate, but the logic is basically the same, and to explain his logic would take way too long. But at any rate, he's going to acquaint where a flower is placed with how tall it is. And this will change by the section. So he might say, for example, that every time a flower is placed on the 10th line, it's going to be a 5-inch flower. Let's say every time a flower occurs on the 6th one, it's going to be a 2-inch flower. Since there are only 6 heights, each one will be equated with 2 different numbers. So let's say 5 inches would be also for ones that land on 1. So now you're beginning to see partially what's going to happen, right? You're going to have a series of movement of these, and they're going to vary depending on the height or loudness. And loudness or height is always going to be somehow linked up with where it's placed. Okay? Now, where do you place it on the vertical? That should be a little more obvious. You could take the same series again, and let's say the first one goes on the vertical number 1. And since it starts on the 5th one, it starts on this vertical. Now, the next time I want to plant, it will go on the 12th. He gives himself the same choices. The next time I want to plant, I can either repeat the same one I had last time, I can put it on 1 again vertically, or I can move on to the next one and go to 12. But if I move on, I can't go back. Okay? So those are some of the basic rules associated. Now let's talk about it in some more details. Let's say, for example, we have two people playing at once, the duet. Or we're planting two flowers at the same time. Well, one of the rules that he's going to give himself is that each one of these vertical units must be filled one time before he can repeat any. That's the whole serial procedure. Another thing he's going to do is he's going to play a game which is called partitioning in 12-tone music. And that's, let's say I have two kinds of flowers at the same time. That doesn't mean I have 6 of one and 6 of the other. I might have 9 of one and 3 of the other. 8 of one and 4 of the other. and he's going to go through all of the different combinations he can. In Aria da Capo, he goes through 58 different ways of combining instruments in this kind of partitioning. So that means I'm going to have sort of groups, right, at a certain stage. I'm going to have like maybe 9 chrysanthemums and only 3 roses. And other times I'm going to have fairly equal weighting. And other times it's going to get quite lopsided. I might have 11 roses and only 1 chrysanthemum. Okay? Now each flower, though, has to go through this sequence, or a related one to it. It's not always the same one, but it's related to it, before it can repeat one again, just the same way with pitches. Now, one of the things that's interesting about that is that at first it seems like there's a one-on-one correspondence. Where you place it and what the pitch is would always be related. But he doesn't move at the same speed at all. He usually repeats his duration things many, many more times than he repeats pitches. So this sequence of it going by horizontally moves at a much slower rate because he keeps repeating more and more than pitches. Usually it goes by about twice as slow. And it doesn't end at the end of a row. It keeps overlapping into the next one. Where the pitches all, or the groups of flowers all end at the end of a section. Another thing he does, which is sort of wonderful in the asymmetry of this whole thing, is let's say this grid that I have, my 12 by 12, let's say I can stretch it or compress it. And let's say I'm still doing my duet here. Well, let's say the roses are planted at 1-inch intervals, just like we talked about. But let's say I compress my grid a little bit so it's only 9 inches long for my chrysanthemums. So the chrysanthemums are now moving at a slightly different rate than the roses, and you start getting this counterpoint. And usually what he does is have up to 6 different levels of compressions and expansions going on at the same time. But all following this notion that it has to occur right at a certain point on this grid. But the grid itself, as I say, can be stretched or compressed. Now, the next thing is, very often, let's say, he wants to emphasize a particular part or give more material to a certain instrument because he wants to make it more important. Well, what he'll do then is give that player maybe 2 or even 3 forms of this series, not the same one, but maybe transposed or inverted or retrograded at the same time. So they're playing 3 different series at the same time. How do you differentiate 3 different series? Well, he does it by, in this case, what I call your 3 shades of red, for example, which equates in Milton's music to register. Let's say one series will always be real high up, and another series will be real low down, and the other one will be in the middle. So you'll hear, for example, in the flute piece, which is what, next Monday or whenever that is, a week from Monday, a lot of big skipping around a lot of times. Sometimes you'll hear lines, but generally you'll hear big skipping around. When you hear a line, he gives it one shade, or one like medium red. But when he's giving you 2 or 3 lines at the same time, he's going to differentiate that with the brightness. So now in this complex garden that always goes 5-2-2-3-3-1-4, we've got the complexity now arising of where the flowers are placed, both horizontally and vertically, how high they are, and how bright they are. This is getting fairly complex when you start thinking about translating this into musical ideas. Remember I said non-pitch percussion doesn't count? Well, it's sort of like in this garden, I take non-flowering ferns. And if I want to decorate something because it needs decoration, I don't need to justify it so much with all of this logic. I simply put the fern in. And that's what the unpitched percussion is. It never counts in terms of these kinds of series and all of the other things I'm talking about. They ornament other things going on. Then on top of this whole thing, let's say of each type of flower, I have a special one, or let's say 5 or 6 special of each one. Let's say with my deep red roses, I have a bunch of them that have beautiful white tips. And these are going to be scattered in the garden in such a way as to reflect the whole logic of the garden, but in a very, very large way, so that if you could look at the garden from above, like from a helicopter or something, you would see this secondary shape arising from where all the special flowers are in the garden. And this Babbitt will do in all of his pieces, and given a kind of underpinning of where the logic of what the piece is about is somehow reflected on a large scale. So with all of these images, you can see how many different ways you can start looking at this garden. First of all, you could see the whole large shape of it, which would have a kind of uniformity to it about it, because you would have these waves, you would have the blocks of all five colors gradually thinning out to only one color and then coming back. You would also have the ability to look at just any individual row. You have the ability to look at any individual plant. And consequently, I think we're getting back to that notion of where are the limits of perception? Can you perceive all these relationships in a garden at once? I don't see how. There's just too much information. And the same with Babbitt's music, and that's why ultimately it arrives at a kind of staticity, because everything is reflecting everything else. If you wanted the final metaphor for this garden in a Babbitt kind of way, take the whole garden, the way I've explained it, and surround it with mirrors. So that everywhere you look, you're not only seeing the garden, you're seeing the garden self-reflected upon itself in all sorts of different ways. And this is essentially how Babbitt constructs a piece like Concertini or Aria da Capo. In a way, this is a very simplistic way of looking at it, but what I've covered essentially are about 9 different things that he's governing by this logical series. He's governing dynamics, articulation, register, pitch, duration, et cetera, et cetera. So the process itself is highly, highly restrictive in many, many ways, and leads to this kind of very strange music. And it's funny because even though Babbitt takes a stance of being sort of the ultra-conservative in some ways, I think his music is some of the most avant-garde music ever written in American history. It's very strange music. I love it. I'm not saying that that is, but it's a very, very different kind of music than you, as you'll hear, like that Donald Martino comes up with in The Next Generation. So there's a kind of implicit thing with Babbitt, because ultimately everything's neutral at the end, right? We have every possible duet, we have every possible pitch, we have every possible duration. So in the end, Babbitt's saying that if we have ultimate order, everything is fair, and if everything's fair, everything is beautiful. In Cage, we have just the opposite. It's a real yin-yang. With Cage, we have him saying everything is beautiful, therefore everything's fair. It's just the opposite, but it's somehow very, very similar. Now, as we gradually move on to Elliot Carter, I think you can find a corollary much more with Charles Ives than you can with either Cage or Babbitt. It's funny, with Carter, although he's known as, you know, this highly intellectual kind of composer and all, he's never really been accepted by the Babbitt school as being rigorous enough in his music. They always feel that there's a little too much looseness, a little too much expressivity, not enough rigor in the way he works. And certainly he's never been accepted by the Cage school, so he's always been sort of on the fringe of all of this. Carter's a very interesting fellow. Let me play just a little bit of a piece of his from 1940, before his style changed to what you've been listening to. He didn't really come into his own compositionally, into a style that he really felt comfortable with, until he was almost over 40 years old in his first string quartet in 1951. And he was born in 1908. So this is a piece, I'll just play a little bit of it. It's called Pastoral, and it's from 1940. Other pieces you've heard, you might not have guessed that's Elliot Carter. The style that piece is written in is what's called neoclassical, and it was a very, very popular style, especially in the 30s. And it was made popular essentially by Igor Stravinsky. We've talked about him quite a bit. He was still in Europe at the time. Stravinsky never taught very much, But there was a very famous French woman who taught essentially what Stravinsky believed. And almost everyone went to study with her. Aaron Copland studied with her. Walter Piston, who taught here, studied with her, who was one of the people Carter knew. And Carter ultimately studied with her also. What's interesting about this piece is something you didn't have enough time to hear. Namely, on one level, it's very conservative, isn't it? I mean, it's very neoclassic. It's, you know, quite beautiful. It does everything neoclassic music's supposed to do. But it doesn't do something that other neoclassic pieces do. If you take a word like neoclassical, you would assume that not only does it sound reminiscent of a kind of classical style, but the forms that you use would also be somehow derived from classical forms. But Carter was always a kind of renegade, and this piece, although it's written in a quote-unquote neoclassic style, there's no form to it. He was thinking of it as a free improvisation, like a jazz piece. So he just simply writes what he feels like writing all the time, which was something that was not done in this particular style, because, as I say, usually the form was very clear and kind of somehow reminiscent of traditional style. So there's this interesting duality in this piece, already in 1940, and it's this duality which I think is the essence of Carter's music and something that at first often confuses people when they start listening to it. Carter, of all the composers, I don't mean the term mentally, but had a very kind of schizophrenic upbringing. He grew up in New York City, as I explained to you before, in a very rich family, and the family were merchants. They imported lace from mostly Belgium and Switzerland. As I explained to you before, also, his parents hated the idea of his going into music and only begrudgingly let him have piano lessons at an early age, were horrified at the notion of his ever becoming a composer, and essentially I remember telling you that his father, rather than accepting Carter being a composer, gave away his company to the employees rather than to Carter himself, leaving him relatively destitute for certain periods of his life. But Carter, of all the composers I know, I think is the first one who was really able to take advantage of the American avant-garde scene when he was young. He took piano lessons from a very progressive teacher in New York City. And the teacher, among other things, was a good friend of Charles Ives. So Carter met Ives when he was 16 years old. Now here we have a real yin-yang. We've got Charles Ives, whose father was a musician, who gives up composition to go into business. And now we have Elliot Carter, who comes from a business family, who gives up business to go into composition. They had an interesting relationship. Carter didn't approve of a lot of what Ives was doing in his music, and I'll talk more about that in a little while. And at the same time, he was this kind of model of a new way of writing music, a way of questioning authority, breaking out of the context of how you're supposed to write. And there's a program of a piano recital he gave when he was still a teenager, 16, 17 years old, where he even plays the Thoreau movement of the Hawthorne, of the Concord Sonata of Charles Ives, as well as Ballet Mécanique of George Antheil. Now, New York, the avant-garde scene there, as you can imagine, was not huge. And Carter was accepted into it as this young kid because he was a friend of this pianist. So early on, he met Varèse, and he was very impressed with Varèse's music, this idea of this sound quality, this massive sound, like sculpting sound rather than composing music, sculpting sound. At the same time, he knew Dane Rudyard. At the same time, he knew George Antheil. He knew another very interesting composer then, if I mentioned Leo Ornstein. Leo Ornstein was a lot like Antheil. He was a young pianist who was very, very, very popular, especially in Europe, who retired at the age of 28 because he got nervous when he played the piano. And already at that stage, two biographies were written about him. He was so famous. And then essentially, he's still alive. He's going to be 100 next year. Most of his life, he moved to a trailer in Brownsville, Texas. Still writes music every single day of the week. No, never shows it to anyone. Never played, and he's written now since 1928, basically in complete isolation with this incredible passion. He moved to Michigan a few years ago when his wife died, and he's living with some of his children at this stage, who must be fairly old themselves, I would guess, if he's going to be 100. Ornstein, O-R-N-S-T-E-I-N, Leo. You'll find recordings of his early music. It's a lot like that sort of modernistic stuff you heard from the 20s. You know, a lot of clusters and energy and that kind of thing in it. So at any rate, what he gets from Ives is not a direct compositional influence, but this idea that a lot of independence can happen in music. Many things can go on at the same time. I remember the first time I heard him lecture, Carter. He said, two people never dress exactly the same. Two people never say exactly the same thing at the same time, except for maybe a word or two. He said, I think it's immoral in a piece of music to make two people play the same thing at the same time. It's a very kind of Ivesian approach. The other thing he gets from Ives is this notion of writing music that's not expressive so much of personal emotion, but of universal things, big things, you know, like chaos and interesting notions of disorder and things of that sort. Ives wrote his last piece that he started working on in 1915 was a piece called The Universe Symphony. And he never really expected it to be, in fact, there was no way it ever could be played. It's in a way the first piece I know of conceptual music, the idea of thinking of a piece that can never happen. And he had this notion you'd be outdoors in the huge countryside, and on one mountain there'd be like an orchestra, and over there there'd be like a chorus, and over there there would be some marching band, and over there there'd be something else. And he started, and he even thought that there's no reason that I have to write the whole piece. It can become a universal project. After I finish, someone else can add on to it, and it'll go on forever, and we'll have this universe symphony. He called it the full expression of the universe in sound. And Ives said of it, the underlying plan of which is a presentation and contemplation in tones, rather than in music as such, of the mysterious creation of the earth and firmament, the evolution of all life in nature and in humanity to the divine. So, on one level, we've got Carter very aware of what's going on in American music and the American avant-garde, not only intellectually, but playing it. And on another level, there's a whole European side to him. He could speak French before he could even read English. He spoke French at a very early age. He has amazing ear for languages, by the way. He speaks Greek very well and reads Latin very well. And he reads Greek just for fun every night. But at any rate, every summer he would go to Europe with his parents because they were lace importers. And he was expected to take over the company, so in a sense they were educating him from a very early age. Now when he went to Europe, he had the possibility of hearing the European avant-garde. In those days, people like Schoenberg and Stravinsky, and people like Scriabin and some of the other composers, were all living in Europe, and not that much of their music was played in this country yet. But he could buy piano pieces and study them, he could go to concerts and hear it. So on the one level, he's very well educated in American music, and on another level, he's very well educated in European music. And he's the only composer I know like this, really, of his generation that really has his foot on both sides. I think, in a sense, if there's a kind of an objection from the Babbitt school towards Carter, it's this European side of Carter, which tends to be much more expressive. His music's always about something. Certain processes govern his music, but they govern it in order to express some idea. And usually the idea, as I say, is a very universal idea. For example, the piece you're going to be listening to, and which we'll talk quite a bit about, called his Double Concerto, the whole piece is about chaos. And it's in seven sections. Each section represents chaos in a different way. But he orders chaos. He doesn't get chaos through chance procedures. He orders it through very rigorous procedures. So on the one hand, you've got this expression of chaos, which is kind of a real Ivesian idea. And then on the other hand, the way he does it is by constructing rather than destructing, if you will. And the construction is much more of his kind of European sensibility of how to do things. So the interesting thing about this duality is that Carter, rather than trying to get over it like a good 19th century romantic composer would and try to incorporate it into one gestalt, he loved the duality. And so he writes music about duality. He writes music about things that don't go together, that can't exist together, that don't seem to fit. Now, he wasn't satisfied with either the European or the American school from the very beginning. What he disliked about Ives, number one, was he didn't feel that music should be made up of quotations. And all of Ives' music, as you know, has lots of quotations of different styles and things. Carter felt that music should be more pure and should be self-contained and non-referential to things outside of itself. The other thing he didn't like about Ives was the messiness. Carter's very orderly. Ives' music was in total disarray. Carter was one of the people that tried to help Ives out a lot by editing some of his manuscripts. They would go into these trunks and just find thousands of pages. Sometimes they went together, sometimes they didn't. They had pieced them together and to try to get the pieces back together. Finally, Carter just got so upset with the messiness of this whole thing that he gave up doing it, although he helped. He made sure other people did. And the pieces that he edited or made sure were performed, two of which you've heard. One is the unanswered question, which is where those three things go together, you know, with the trumpet asking the question and the strings being the druid and the little wind ensemble. And the other is Central Park in the Dark, which you heard very early on, I think, the first week, which has, again, a lot of things going on at the same time that don't seem to really fit together. The other piece that he was responsible for getting performed was the Fourth Symphony, which is an extreme example of many things going on at the same time that don't seem to fit together. In fact, it takes several conductors to conduct it because what people are playing don't even relate to each other. So he's upset about the quotes, he's upset about the messiness. What does he dislike about the European notion? Well, this teacher he studied with, her name was Nadia Boulanger. It's a great name, isn't it? She ended up in Cambridge for a few years, in fact, and taught here somewhere. Well, she was sort of like the main teacher in Europe for years and years and years. As I say, from the Stravinsky point of view, not the Schoenberg point of view. And what Stravinsky represented in the 20s was a style which we call modernism, and I think you have some articles in your source book about modernism. Modernism is essentially non-representational art. Certain Schoenberg pieces are called modern. Some of the Stravinsky pieces were. And then Stravinsky started writing in this neoclassic style, which is like what you heard over here. And that's basically what Nadia Boulanger taught in the 30s when Carter was there. He was there from 32 to 35. I think I mentioned Carter was an undergraduate here at Harvard, but he majored in English and classics because he felt that the curriculum was too old-fashioned and irrelevant to what he wanted to learn. He did end up getting his master's in music, which is when his parents started taking away his allowance for the first time. And then he went to Europe, and when he went to Europe and it was clear he was going to be a composer, that's when his parents really had it with him. His father died in like 1955, and his mother didn't die until 1970, and in his entire lifetime they never went to one concert or listened to one record of his works. They were so upset with him. So Carter's in a certain way in a really interesting position of trying to prove himself compositionally because he has this incredible opposition to him and also this duality about it. So when he goes to study with Nadia Boulanger, he feels that modernism isn't expressive for what he wants to do, and he thinks the neoclassic language, even though he dabbles with it a little bit, is too shallow for what he wants to do. So with Nadia Boulanger, he refuses to really study what she normally taught, and he studied what's called strict counterpoint with her. And strict counterpoint is there's an old tradition in music of how you learn how to put note against note, and then two notes against one note, and then three notes against one note, and how to write many lines at the same time. It's sort of like learning how to weave with pitches. And there's an old system of how to teach it that goes way, way back, and she was a very good teacher of that. So he didn't study the normal things with her. He studied the sort of old-fashioned thing of how you combine many elements at the same time. And in fact, when she heard a piece of his later on, her only comment was, "I didn't know you were going to write like that." It's interesting. Poor Carter, he just never had kind of, you know, an acceptance until really about 1960 when he starts really coming into his own, especially with the double concerto. So what's Carter going to do now? He has this image that he wants to write a whole bunch of things going on at the same time, but he doesn't want them quotes. How are you going to go about doing that? Well, the first thing he's going to do is invent a whole pitch language for himself, a way of writing notes that's somehow going to be able to give a different identity to one element than another element. So let's say we have two different things going on in a piece. He wants them to sound differently with the way the pitches are. So he starts looking at all the different pitches you can use. Like, if we have 12 different pitches in the octave, and he always writes in this kind of temperament and octave. The first thing he did was start looking at all the three-note combinations he could have. So let's take this combination. Let's call our pitches 0 through 11, just for my sake. Let's say you have this one, 0, 3, 7. I take the zeroth pitch, the third pitch, and the seventh pitch. That's 037. Now, I want to analyze this in terms of what intervals it has in it, what gives it its sound. and what makes it unique. Now, I see here I have an interval of 0 to 3, which means that 3 is up 3 half steps, 1, 2, 3, and the 7 is up 7 half steps, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. So I have 0 to 3 as an interval of 3, and I have 0 to 7 as an interval of 7. But I need to explain something quickly before we do that. If you think of a clock again, because we're in a mod 12, if you think of a clock again, going, you could either go up 7 or back 5. Now, an interval of going up 7 sounds like this, and going back 5 simply reverses it. It takes this top note and puts it on the bottom. So in terms of the way Carter was thinking about harmony, he considers those the same, because he going back 5 or going up 7 essentially are the same depending on how you compose with them. So he's always going to call the distance between the different intervals the smallest possible interval. So 0 to 7 in his mind, it's quicker to go down 5 than around 7. So he's going to call that interval 5. Okay, and then the interval here, 3 to 7, is the interval of 4. So in this, we can say we have no intervals of 1, no intervals of 2, one interval of 3, one interval of 4, one interval of 5, and no intervals of 6. And you'll never have a bigger interval than 6, because you can always go back on the clock or forward on the clock. We're not talking about time in this case. So this particular sound, this particular harmony about it, if you will. This is very different, for example, than the harmony that I get if I do 0-1-2. I mean, that sounds different than that, obviously. If I analyze what intervals I have here, I have a 1, I have a 2, and I have a 1. So my interval vector would be there are 2 1s, 1, 2, and none of the rest. Now, Carter found that when he tried every possible three-note collection this way, there are only 12 different harmonies in terms of these kinds of things. All the combinations, they might, sure, this harmony can be moved up, but this is still the same harmony. This is still the same harmony. This is still the same harmony. So he found that all of a sudden, in this huge mass of possibilities, boy, oh boy, we only have now only 12 different combinations of three notes. He called this his harmony notebook. The next thing he started doing was looking at possible four-note collections. And when he started looking at four-note collections, again, he found all of a sudden that what seemed like an enormous quantity of different things all of a sudden reduced to only 29 different harmonies. That's not so bad. And they could sound very different. Like, let's take this one. Okay. Now, that one could be characterized by the harmony of having an interval of 3. 0 to 6 would be 6. 0 to 9 would be 3. 3 to 6 would be 3. 3 to 9 would be 6. And 6 to 9 would be 3. So this has no 1s, no 2s, 4 3s, no 4s, no 5s, and 2 6s, which would be, of course, a very different harmony than the one which I'll show you at the beginning of next class. So then he did the same thing with 5 notes, 6 notes, 7 notes, etc. And with 6 notes, he found that there are only 35 different harmonies. Now, a composer like Carter, or almost anyone who works a lot with numbers, when they're thinking about harmony, they can see these. When I see, like, 03, I hear this. I'm not thinking it abstractly. I really hear that. When I see 06, I really hear that. And when you start playing with this enough, when you see 0369, in your ear right away is... Now, this is not unusual for composers. Even Bach represented much of his music with just numbers, because the numbers could be converted in your ear to pitches. And in many ways, it's easier to look at it as numbers than pitches. So with these different kinds of harmonies now, he's got the possibility of differentiating different layers in his music. For example, when I showed you those two three-note chords, he might give one layer this harmony and another layer this harmony. And they sound very different. So this is the first thing he's going to do. The next thing he's going to do, which we'll start with next time, is figuring out how to give people different tempos or different rhythms at the same time so that they can have an identity that's not only associated with harmony, but also with tempo and rhythm. And that's where his music starts getting fairly complex in terms of playing. And then what we'll do next time is I'll show you how all of this applies to the double concerto and how the poetry of the double concerto demands the processes that bring it about. So we see each other next Wednesday, I believe. Monday's a holiday.